And we're going to do a temporary mute for everybody just to keep background noise to a minimum. Feel free to unmute as you want to chime in. And I think one more thing I need to do. Okay. So everybody should be seeing me and the shared screen. Is that correct? Okay. We finished our more or less our introduction to the broad background on approaches to the story, approaches to Medrash, approaches to questions related to stories in Tanakh in which we find individuals who are otherwise righteous doing things that would seem to be very unrighteous. We've explored this from various angles. A lot of the material we've actually looked at, we're going to come back to because it'll kind of weave its way into our study of the text itself. And certainly the first subject, which is the relationship between David and Bathsheba, is going to revisit some of the material we've already encountered. But moving forward, my hope is to do so systematically from a study of the text. So we've kind of done a four-week introduction. I think the story of David and Bathsheba needs that kind of introduction just in terms of an approach. And at this point, I want to go back to the story, reread parts of it, and as we've done in the past, kind of work through the specific issues as they appear and kind of structure this as best we can. I said at the outset when we started this that unique amongst the stories of Tanakh, David and Bathsheba is a relatively contained story, meaning it's two chapters, but there's so much material and so much breadth that we need to address, variables, that the complexity is going to make it a very systematic but slow. We're going to take it slow. My goal for this year is to focus on this story in particular. So we're going to jump back into the text. You have the text in front of you, or you can use a Tanakh. We are Shmuel Bet Perek Yud Aleph. We read it when we first started in the first week, and we're going to read parts of it again now, and then we'll jump in. Vahil Tshuvat Hashana, a year later. A year later means the background to this story is the battle that we saw at the end of chapter 10, which is after a series of wars, a war with Ammon, a war with Moab, a war with Edom, a war with Aram in Syria. David's expanse was a series of campaigns that has expanded David's kingdom into a broad international player and kind of an empire, all the way up to the Euphrates. But the last piece of this is a war against Ammon and the capital of Ammon, which is a walled city, Rabbah. And they've started a siege. And the siege of Ammon will take a long time. So in the meantime, L'Tshuvat Hashana, year later, L'Eit Tzeta Melachim, V'Yishlach David et Yoav et Avadav Imo et Kol Yisrael, V'Yashchitu et Bnei Ammon. David sent Yoav, his general, the army, all of Israel, to go and attack the city of Ammon, Vayatsuru al Rabbah, besiege the city of Rabbah, v'David yoshev b'Yerushalayim. And David returns to Yerushalayim. There's no point in David sitting on the battlefield for months on end when they are working through the attrition of a siege war against Rabbah. And so David kind of returns to Yerushalayim and leaves the siege to his general. Vahila Eta Erev came to pass one evening. Vayakom David me'al mishkavo. David arose from his bed. Vayitalech al gag bet ha-melech. He was walking on the rooftop of his palace. Vayar ishar chetzet me'al gag. And I'm already going to bias our translation because this is somewhat of a subject of discussion, but from his rooftop, he saw a woman who was bathing, meaning the Me'al HaGag goes back to the description of David, right? Contrary to what some translate as she was bathing on the roof, that is not the case. David was walking on the roof, Vayitalech Agag. And from that vantage point, Me'al Agag, Vayar Isha Rechetzet, he saw a woman bathing. Vayisha Tavat Mar'eh Me'od, very beautiful woman. Vayishlach David, Vaydrosh Li'isha. So David sent an inquiry, who is she? Investigate. Vayomer, he was told, Alazot Batsheva Bat Eliam Eshet Uriah Hachiti. This is Batsheva, daughter of Eliam, who at this point we do not necessarily know who that is. Much later in Tanakh, we learn that David has an advisor by the name of Achitophel. Eliam is Achitophel's son. So essentially, Batsheva is his advisor. Gemara calls Achitophel David's Rebbe, but he's certainly an advisor of David. And Batsheva is the granddaughter, but Eliam, who is the son of Achitophel. That's a piece of story we don't necessarily see here, but it appears later in the end of the Sefer. Eshet Uriah Achiti. This Batsheva is the wife of Uriah Achiti. Vayishlach David Malachim. David sent messengers. Vayikacheha. And took her, brought her. Vatavoelav, she came to him. Vayishkavima, he lay with her. She was purified from her state of tuma, from the status as Anida. Unclear whether that's just a description of her in terms of where she was explaining why later in the story she gets pregnant from the one night that she has with David, or a description of the context in which she was bathing, which is also possible, although be a little bit harder, but it's possible. Vatashov el beta, and then she returned to her house. Vataha ha'isha, she conceived. Vatishlach vataged leDavid, vatomer hara anochi. She conceived, she sent a message to David and said, I am with child. So you understand that several months have transpired between the engagement David has with Batsheva and now the rest of the story, because obviously she has discovered that she's pregnant. And in this time, Uriah is still on the battlefield. Vayishlach David al Yoav. David sent a message to Yoav. Shlach elai et Uriah Achiti. Send Uriah Achiti to me. Which was not uncommon, because they would send messengers from the battlefield to the king to report what was going on. And so David requests that that Yoav send Uriah Achiti as that messenger. Vayishlach Yoav et Uriah el David. Yoav sent Uriah. Vayavo Uriah elav. Uriah comes to him. Vayishal David lishlam Yoav, lishlam ha'am, lishlam ha'milchama. And David inquires exactly what you would anticipate David to inquire of, namely, the state of the war, the state of Yoav, the state of the army, the state of the campaign. Vayomer David l'Uriah, after the report is given, David further says to Uriah, Red lebetcha urchatz raglecha. Go down to your house and wash your feet. Wash your feet, of course, being a euphemism for go home to your wife. Vayetze Uriah mibet ha-melech, vateitze acharav masat ha-melech. Uriah departs from the king's house, and together with food that was provided to him by the king. Vayishkav Uriah petach bet ha-melech. Uriah slept at the door of the king's house. He did not want to go home. Et kol avdei Adonav, together with all of the servants in the house of the king. Velo yarad el beito. And he did not return, go down to his house. Yagidu leDavid lemor. When David heard, lo yarad Uriah el beito, that Uriah did not go back to his house as David had instructed him, You've come from a long journey. Why did you not go to your house? Uriah's response to David is very clear. Haron v'Yisrael v'Yuda yoshvim basukot. The ark, the army of Israel, the army of Judah, are sitting in Sukkot, which is either a reference to a city or in booths created in the on battlefield temporary dwellings, meaning they're all sitting in the army, in the camp. And my master, my lord Yoav, and the servants of my lord are all encamped on the open field. And I should go back to my house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife. Chayecha, v'chei nafshecha, im eset hadavar hazeh, on your life, and as you live, I will not do this thing. And what ensues from here, which we're going to leave for another discussion, is a conversation between David and Uriah about a series of conversations that take place over a night or two, about going back to his house, and Uriah refuses, and finally, David sends him to the battlefield, and with instructions to Yoav to put him in a dangerous place. That's part one of the story. And our focus for now is going to be on the relationship between David and Bathsheba. And we'll get to all the rest of it, Uriah and other variables in the story as time progresses. I just want to, before we move into a discussion of it, I want to do a quick look at the next parak. So obviously we've talked about this. Uriah dies at the end of the story. You know what? Might as well read it. David tells Uriah to stay the night. Yom David Uriah Yashib Bezeh Gama Yom Machar. Yishlachacha, I'll send you tomorrow. So the night that Uriah spends the night in Yerushalayim. And the next day, v'yukralo David v'yocha v'lefana v'yesh v'yishakreu, he eat and drink, v'yitzeh be'erav lishkab mishkavoyim avdei Adonav, and again the next night he sleeps with his servants in the by the palace. And the next day, v'yibaboka v'yichtob David sefer Yoav v'yishlach biyad Uriah. Next day, David writes a letter, sends to Uriah, and in that letter, he tells Uriah to play, tells Yoav to place Uriah at the front, and then to retreat from him, meaning not to give him the backup that he needs. So it happens, and I'm going to skip a little bit after the death of Uriah. V'tishma eshet Uriah ki met Uriah. When Mrs. Uriah, otherwise known as Bathsheba, hears that Uriah, her husband, died, Vatispodo Ba'ala, she lamented, offered a eulogy for her husband. David, after the mourning was passed, David sent messengers by Asfal Beto, took Bathsheba into his house, Vatilo Isha, marries her, Vatelet Lo Ben, and they have a child. Assuming, of course, logical assumption that this child is the one with whom she was pregnant in the first place, namely the child born of the union of David and Bathsheba. Vayera hadavar asher asad David ben Asher. And this matter was greatly displeasing in the eyes of God. Vayishlach Hashem et Natan el David. God sent Natan, the Navi, to David. Vayavoylav. He comes to him and he tells him the following. Once upon a time, I'm going to tell you a story, my dear David. Shnei anashim ayu be'ir achat, two people in the city, echad ashir ve'echad rash, one rich and the other poor. La'ashir ha'yatzon uvakar ha'be'ma'od, the rich man had many flocks and herds. V'la'rash ein kol ki'im kivsa achat k'tana. Poor man had nothing but one little ewe lamb. He had bought and he reared and he grew up together. together with his children, Mipito tochal, Mikiso tishte, this little lamb ate of his bread and drank of his cup, Ubechekot ishkav, and this little lamb lay in his bosom, but Batilo kivat, it was like a daughter to him. Traveling guest came to the wealthy man, and he didn't want to take of his own flock over his own herd, to offer food to the guest who is coming. And so instead, he took the lamb of this poor man, and he used it as a feast, a barbecue for the man who came to visit. David was angry greatly at this man. Such a man who could do such a horrible thing is deserving to die. And pay back that lamb fourfold. Because he did this thing without compassion. Natan said to David, you are that man. For now, that's all we're going to cover. All right. So a lot of different variables. And part of the address to the story of David and Bathsheba is to understand all the relationships. So we need to understand the relationship between David and Bathsheba, between Bathsheba and Uriah, between David and Uriah, between David and Yoav. Between David and Natan, the message of Natan, all the variables, all the players in this story, each one is a story and a half. But we're going to start with David and Bathsheba. We're going to start with the main issue on the table, which of course is, what was the relationship between David and Bathsheba, and more importantly, between Bathsheba and Uriah, and ultimately ask the question, was David guilty of adultery? It's a question we begun to explore. We had explored it in various contexts in the introduction when we looked at the various midrashim and how Chazal saw the relationship between whether or not David was guilty of adultery in terms of the relationship between Uriah and Bathsheba, whether there was a get, etc. We talked a little bit about that in the introduction, but I want to explore it as its own subject today, specifically in the context of the text of the safe of the story. And this is really where our discussion begins. So some of this material is going to be a bit of a review, but I want to organize it systematically as we move forward. So the question starts with a basic core issue. On the face of it, it would seem that David and Bathsheba, in that first night that they have a union together, she is married to Uriah. That makes that relationship one of adultery. That makes the child born of that union a mamzer. And that makes both David and Bathsheba guilty of a capital offense for which the punishment is death. I want to be very clear on this point. Classic adultery in the Torah's language is a capital offense. Happens to be a subject of some controversy in today's news, but nonetheless, we're not talking about today's world, we're talking about the biblical world, and it's very clear, and I'll share with you the source page, which, by the way, I should put in the chat, so I will do so right now. If anybody is, this is the new source page, it's not from previous weeks, so I will put it in the chat. You're welcome to download it if you wish, and otherwise I post it here. Pasuk in Vayikra, which is very clear and unambiguous, ish ashein af et ishet ish ashein af et ishet re'eu. If a man commits adultery with a married woman, another man's wife, mot yumat no'ef banu'afet, the adulteress and the adulterer shall both be put to death. Adultery in the Torah is a capital offense punishable by death, both the woman and the suitor, meaning the adulterer. Mishnah and Sanhedrin codifies this.
It sounds like that's mutual.
Excuse me?
That pasuk in Vayikra seems like that would be a mutual relationship, that they
correct,
both
correct.
Want relations.
Without question. Adultery is only a capital offense on both sides if it is mutual, consenting. Correct.
So that's not so clear from the Torah that she wanted to have a relationship with him.
Well, we haven't gotten to this story yet. I'm just, let's frame the context of the halacha, and then we'll come back to the story. Mishnah, sorry, also Elohen and Nechnakim, these are capital offenses. Haba Alei Shadish, one who commits adultery. It's the Torah has a different set of parameters altogether with the cases of ones and of forced relationships and rape, etc. It's a whole different set of variables. But this is talking about classic adultery, you know, woman and man having an affair, extramarital affair. Habal Eshet Ish, that is a capital offense. Which means, and on top of everything, on top of it just being a capital offense, it's also one of the big three, right? It's also, we talk about the big three for which a person is obligated to give their life, adultery, idolatry, and murder. It's one of the big three. It's clearly the most significant issue in the story. If they are guilty of adultery in the classic sense of the term, there's a whole host of issues that come into play. Capital punishment, remarriage to each other after the death of Uriah, etc. So the question that I want to start with basically is, what does the text tell me? Was their relationship one of adultery? So if I go back to the story itself, there are really two ways to look at the text, but on the one hand, on a simple reading of the text, it's pretty clear that the text wants me to recognize that David's relationship with Bathsheba is while she is married to Uriah. I think that that, on a simple level, is quite clear. Pasuk Gimel, Vayishlach David Vayidrosh Liisha, David sent and inquired of the woman. Vayomer was told, Halozot Bathsheba Bat Eliam, Eshet Uriah Hachiti, the wife of Uriah Hachiti. Similarly, when David calls Uriah back from the battlefield, which we all understand is a way of sending Uriah home in the hope that he would cover for the lineage of this child, illegitimate child born that was conceived. Uriah refuses. We'll talk about why Uriah refuses another time. But in this reference that Uriah makes, in this speech that Uriah makes to David, he says, I'm not going home. All my fellow soldiers are on the battlefield. My commander is on the battlefield, and I should go home to my home. I should go home to eat and drink and to lie with my wife. Again, im ishti. The reference is very clear. Furthermore, when Natan, after the story, criticizes David and says to him, you are the individual, and therefore you will be punished for this action, for your moral lapse, etc. The decree that Natan declares and the punishment that Natan puts in place is a lengthy one and a harsh one. Accuses him of killing Uriah and taking his wife and marrying her, etc. In that Perigit Bet, in that Tochacha of Natan HaNavi, he says to him, Ko Amar Hashem, Hinini Mekim Alecha Ra'ami Beitecha, I will set up evil out of your own house. V'lakachti et Nashecha Le'enecha V'natati L'Re'echa, I will take your wives before you and give them to your neighbor, which is part of the rebellion of Avshalom, where Avshalom takes the concubines of David and uses them to demonstrate his taking over of the power of the king, lies with them in the public on the rooftop of the palace, kind of a measure for measure punishment to David. But if the measure for measure is punishment for David, I will take your wives from before you, that would assume that the initial chait was David's violation of somebody else's wife in the context of the story. So from all points of reference so far that we have seen, it would be self-evident that David essentially took Bathsheba that first night. There's three parts to the story. There's the initial relationship they have that night that David takes Bathsheba. There's the story of Uriah and David having Uriah killed on the battlefield. And then there's the marriage of David and Bathsheba subsequent to. There's just three parts to the story, and we have to address them all. But initially, that first night, it would seem from the text that everything points to Uriah and Bathsheba being legally married and David taking Bathsheba as an act of adultery, and raises the question of what transpired. It would seem, and I'll pause for a moment for comment, it would seem that from this perspective, what we're dealing with is David, who was a man of great passion and great emotion, kind of losing his sense of judgment and just falling prey to the desire and temptation of this beautiful woman who he happened to get a glance of bathing through the window. And kind of the Yetzer has overcome him, and he pulls her into the palace, and they have a relationship, and they have a what we would call a one night together, and the rest, as they say, is history. On the face of it, that seems to be the story. And
But you did say before that the custom was to give them a get before they went to
poor. We're going to get to that issue. So that's exactly what I want to divide up. I want to divide up the two ways to look at the story. Right. So I have the basic reading of the text. If I look at it closely and I look at the language, would seem to, and Dina, you're correct, would seem to indicate that their relationship, that she is still legally Eshet Uriah Achiti, and that David is not only dealing with the question of, you know, there's two different issues when you're dealing with the question of sexuality in Tanakh. There's norms that were just different than they are today. Yehuda goes to Tamar dressed as a prostitute, and everybody raises the question of the, she's his daughter-in-law and the union and whether it's legal, etc. But nobody really addresses the question of, okay, so how do you understand that Yehuda goes to have a night with a prostitute? Like, that initial context of it, just on that level, is so odd. There's a certain kind of level of address to this question that doesn't really get a lot of time or focus, which is the question of how could David have done this altogether, forgetting who she is. Let's assume for the moment she's nobody. Right? How could David have done this? But it becomes much worse considering the fact that at least the text presents us with the picture of her being married to Uriah, and therefore this being an act of adultery. As adultery, it's unforgivable.
Rabbi, is Bathsheba Jewish? And if she is her marriage to Uriah recognized because he's a Chiti?
You're making three assumptions there, which we'll come back to much later in the story. Right now, I'm assuming everybody's Jewish. But you are making a correct assumption, but it's much later. It's raising an interesting question, which we'll come back to at a much later stage. But for now, I'm taking it as a given that everybody here is Jewish. We'll deal with that question on its own merit. If not today, then next week. But it's a powerful question. So that's part one. Part one is a, or one perspective, is that if I look at the text closely, I have three different references to Bathsheba as Eshet Uriah. And that places the story in an unequivocal, unambiguous position. This is adultery, and David is simply fallen prey to his own temptation. And
I have a comment.
Doesn't much more that that we can do with that, except raise the question that if that's the case, then how is he allowed to marry her? Because he's not allowed to marry the a man is in an affair with a woman, and the husband, and then the woman either gets divorced or the husband dies, they're not allowed to marry her. That's a we'll come back to that halacha in a moment. That's one part of the question. And the other part of the question, of course, is, we'll see what the other part of the question is.
Is it, Rabbi?
Yeah.
The question I have is, doesn't the king kind of trump rules in this, in regards that he's the king? I mean, I may be putting the Middle Ages feudal society structure upon the structure under the king, you know, David HaMelech, but there's the whole, you know, feudal structure that makes, you know, all these people are his property. They're all his servants. You know, Yoav is his servant, and the servants have to provide, if he's a liege, he's got his own territory, he's got to provide so many troops, that's part of his requirement, you know, that's from a medieval structure. And therefore, you know, we know the prima nota, the first night authority of the Lord, to sleep with the newly married wife. This is not newly married. We don't know how recently they've been married and whether they've even consummated the marriage. We don't know any of those details either here. That's from the text. How long Uriah and Bathsheba have been married? Are they children?
We'll come and address that question later as well.
Okay.
Four steps ahead of me. But the only thing I would caution is not to place the medieval feudal system into the world of Tanakh. At least not as Tanakh wants us to understand it. Meaning, I have to take the world of Tanakh at face value. And at face value, the Torah clearly states that no individual, including the king of Israel, is above the law. That's why Torah requires that a king carry with him and write a Sefer Torah, that lives one with him in, outside of the palace, one with him in the palace. The king is always subject to the direction of the Navi. In the world of Tanakh, it's clear that the king is not above the law under any circumstance, and that would be, that's part of what is at the foundation of Malchut Yisrael. The king is absolutely not in any way above the law that applies to every other member of the Jewish people.
But the flip side, the other half of the question is, what is the status of Uriah and Bathsheba's marriage to begin with?
We'll come back to that a little bit later.
Okay.
But now I take everything at face value, at least as the text presents it, that she is Eshet Uriah Achiti. David takes her. Himit Kadeshet Mitumata. She was purified from her status as Anita, and she comes to him in the house. They have she conceives, and now David is in the dilemma of this adulterous relationship and this bastard child becoming public, and so he needs to take Uriah out of the equation. And the way to do that is initially to send Uriah home so that they can have a night together and he can be out of the picture. His involvement here would be covered up, and unfortunately for David that doesn't happen because Uriah refuses, and so we're left with a different approach.
I just want to raise one thing that we always have the issue of the letter of the law and the spirit of the law.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of effort, you know, that we went through in the introductions that we had about the letter of the law, but still, if you read the story, you don't feel too good.
All right. So let me at the outset make it very clear, and I agree with you, that whenever we say, we need to do exactly what you just described, which is to recognize that there is, throughout the story, a kind of separation between the letter and the spirit of the law, specifically because that's what the Navi holds David accountable for. In other words, the purpose of the story is not to make us feel good. The purpose of the story is not to exonerate David. The purpose of the story is not to justify anything. It's to recognize the two things that are happening. One is the ability of David HaMelech to not only fall into the trap of his own momentary shortcoming, but the delusion of self-justification that takes place in the cover-up subsequently. That is not to justify David's behavior, it's to understand David's behavior. The justification is in the hands of the Navi, and the Navi holds him accountable. So very important to make sure that whatever we identify in terms of a potential, not even justification, but whatever we do in terms of limiting, this is what we talked about the other day about the Rishwa ben Achmeni, where he kind of distinction between the level of the critique of the Navi and the level of the story. Nothing that we say in any context is going to exonerate David from any moral accountability for his actions. That's clear. My only question is understanding how David gets into this position in the first place. All right, I'm going to hold the remaining questions for now. Let me just take us one more step in the story. And that is, we've identified for now one way of reading the text, which is that David is, Bathsheba is legally married, and that this is an act of adultery. Three times it describes Bathsheba as Eshet Uriah Hachiti. The flip side of it, and again, I'm working right now just in terms of text, just in terms of understanding the nuance of what's written. The flip side of it is that to describe the story of David's night with Bathsheba as a kind of momentary David being overwhelmed by the temptation of the moment and just, kind of Hollywood style, just getting carried away with the Bathsheba and a kind of the energy of the temptation. That's very problematic. Problematic for several reasons, including the text. Because if you look at the way that Navi describes what happened, David sees Bathsheba and then inquires of her. Vayishlach David, vayidrosh le'isha. He inquires, okay, who is she? So it's not the case that David's relationship with Bathsheba took place the night he saw her. He saw her from the window. He can't sleep. He's sitting on the thing. He runs to her and they have a relationship. Like, that's not the story. The story is Vayishlach David, vayidrosh le'isha. He inquired after her. And he's told, who is she? Not only who she is, who her husband is, who her lineage is. Bathsheba, bat Eliyah, meshet Uriah Hachiti. There's a whole investigation going on. Furthermore, just common sense. If David is intending to have an adulterous affair that he doesn't want anybody to know about, why on earth would he send for her via several layers of messengers? Vayishlach David malachim. He sent messengers. Vayikachea, and sent her an invitation. Vatavoilav, she came to him. Vayishkavima, v'imitkadeshim mitum. Devet hashavel beita. Then she goes home. Vayishlach, and then she sends a message to him. Vatishlach, vataged the David. So she sends another message to him by another messenger. So how many other people are involved in the story? How many messengers, how many people in the household of David now know that David and Bathsheba had a relationship? If the context here is what the Svarim call Yitzur D'Arayas, the Yetzer of the moment, the sexual desire and drive that just overwhelmed him, I don't understand the level of systematic investigation, careful analysis. This is not a secret one-night stand. This is, who is she? What's her background? Where is she from? What's going on? And then to add layers of shlichim, of messengers to the story, it's virtually impossible for this not to be public information. And in fact, Rashi says so explicitly. Rashi on, interesting Rashi altogether, there's a Gemara in Ksubas which we looked at. We're going to look at it again in a moment in more detail, but there's a Gemara in Ksubas that talks about, that asks the question, why Bathsheba is not prohibited to David after the death of Uriah. We'll come back to that question in a moment. The question the Gemara starts with is, you need witnesses. To convict somebody of adultery, you need witnesses. Witnesses don't have to see the act. They have to see the context and the seclusion, etc. But you need witnesses. Right? It's one of the reasons why the death penalty is almost never implemented in Jewish life, because the level of required testimony is virtually impossible. But that's only for the death sentence. For the actual conviction is much less. But that this is in context of the rule of Sota, that she doesn't become prohibited to her husband unless you have two witnesses with all of the additional requirements. To which the Gemara says, so that's the case. How come Bathsheba wasn't prohibited to David? So immediately there's an assumption that if Bathsheba was to be prohibited to David, that means that there must have been witnesses. To which Rashi adds and says explicitly, many people knew. There's no way to hide when you're the king. You send for her with messengers and you bring her into the palace and you have a wine and dine her, and then you send another, and then she sends messengers. It's a public conversation. For an act of adultery to be so public in the context of David HaMelech is just extraordinary.
But do the Edom actually have to see the act?
No, but they do not. They have to see the seclusion, they have to see the context, etc. But that's exactly what Rashi is saying. There's no way they didn't know. There were many witnesses. Everybody knew. Where does Rashi get the assumption that there were many Edom? Because that's exactly what the text says. Vayishlach David, he sent for him a malachim. He sent messengers. He brought it with messengers. She sent messengers back to him. There's a public conversation going on. Maybe not public, but certainly within the palace. So just to the context of this being a straightforward case of adultery is very odd, given the level of lack of discretion that is evident here in the context of these messengers back and forth. That's one problem. Another problem is a problem we've already identified, which is Natan's message to David. When Natan speaks to David, so he starts with this whole parable, okay, the story of the lamb of the poor man and the lamb of the rich man. So there's two basic questions on this mashal that we're going to have to address at some point as we move forward. One is, why does the Navi need a parable? Why does he need a story? The Nevi'im do not employ these kinds of mashalim and stories in their general critique of the kings. The role of a Navi is to critique the king. Right? The role of the Navi is sort of the equivalent of, the state controller or the Supreme Court. Right? He comes to the king to challenge, to hold the king accountable for his actions. That's what the Navi is doing. The Nevi'im spoke to the kings directly. The Nevi'im did not mince their words. They didn't dance around their words. Yirmiyahu and Yechezkel and Natan and God and Eliyahu, Elio doesn't mince his words. Elio stands before Ahab and says to him, you are an idolatrous, no good, ye son of a gun, and there's not going to be any rain for the next 3 years because you are worshiping idols. He doesn't couch it in parables and the Mishalim. And the Nevi'im spoke to the kings. What do I need a parable for? I need a parable. There are actually three cases of a Navi speaking to a king and or somebody speaking to a king and offering a mashal to get to their point. And we'll look at those three cases when we get to chapter 12. One of ours and there's two others. But outside of those two, but what's common to all three of them is that the story, the mishpat, the judgment, they're all cases of judgment. They're all cases where an individual comes to the king and says, okay, here's a story. How would you rule? And in all three cases, the question of how would you rule is because it's not so clear. The story is not so, the story is not so black and white. What's not black and white if you have adultery? Here's Natan coming to David and he gives him a whole mashal. And what's interesting about this mashal is that he accuses the individual in the story, right? The wealthy man in this story is accused of what? In those first four psukim of chapter 12, the wealthy man in this story is accused of what?
Stealing.
He's accused of stealing without compassion. And David's decree of et kivsa yishalem ba'atayim, you shall pay fourfold, is he is judging him as a thief. He does not accuse him of being adulterous. If David had committed an act of adultery, that overwhelms everything else. Stealing and the moral offense and the lack of compassion. David says that Natan says, or David says that he gets angry because he had no compassion, he had no pity. We're talking about adultery. You don't need pity in the context of adultery. It's a crime in the Torah. It's a black and white offense. If this is adultery in the classic sense of the term, this mashal makes no sense because it whitewashes the most critical issue in the story. So from both of these vantage points, something in the story is missing in terms of the circumstances related to the union of David and Bathsheba. Is there really a case of adultery going on? That's two elements to the question. The third anchor, if you will, in the question, something which we've actually raised a few times, but I want to look at the sources for it, which is that David marries Bathsheba in the end, after the death of Uriah. And the rule with adultery is very clear. I want to show it to you. Mishnah in Sota. The context of all of this is derived from the laws of Sota. And in the context of, right, the way the Torah deals with adultery is through the Mikdash and the waters, the Sota waters, etc. And the waters essentially themselves do bring about the judgment, both for the adulterous woman as well as her husband. No, sorry, as well as her suitor, right, the lover, right, the person who, with whom she has the affair. Kishem shemayim botkin ota, just as the water investigates her, and if she's guilty, she dies. Kach hamayim botkin oto. So too, at the same moment, the identity of the lover is clear because he dies at the same moment that she does. Shenema uvao, etc. And then the Mishnah goes on and says, Kishem shasura labal, kach hasura labal. In the same way that if a person commits adultery, she is prohibited to return to her husband. So too, she's prohibited ever marrying the person with whom she had the affair, even if the husband is no longer in the picture, either because of divorce or death. That is permanent. Kishem shasura labal, kach asura la boel, permanently. Which means that we're dealing with a fundamental problem where David marries Bathsheba. The Navi criticizes him for marrying her, but at the same time, he does not insist that she that he abandon her. He does not tell David to remove this woman from his marriage. She's forbidden to him. Not only is she not removed, but the child they eventually have is given the heir to the throne. And given God's stamp of approval, Yedidiah is called the beloved of God. So there is clearly a imprimatur that is given to this union if it is in fact legally in all context of the initial relationship, one of adultery. There's no way that the Navi could so gloss over something which was so fundamental to the laws of the Torah. So that raises the question, three different angles. Textually, right, their union is not a secret. Legally, they remain married to each other. And spiritually, Natan's message of critique to the Navi does not, to David, does not include reference to adultery, which is a mystery and needs to be resolved. So from all three of these perspectives, Chazal asked this question, and they deal with it on different levels. So let's take a look now at where we started to look at this last week. I want to look at this in a little bit more detail. Essentially, there are two approaches to answering the question of how Bathsheba could legally be remarried to David if this was an act of adultery.
But you know now that it isn't an act of adultery. You already know that before you do anything else.
I don't know anything else. I don't know anything. I have a lot of questions. We know a lot because we've gone through a four-week introduction. But in terms of the approach to the story, I have a mystery that needs to be resolved. So one of the ways of resolving that mystery, Adin is correct, one of the ways of resolving that mystery is the suggestion of the Gemara that Kol Yotzei L'Mechemet Beit David Kotev Get Kritut L'Ishto, that every soldier in the house in the army of David wrote a get to his wife before he went to war. That's one way of addressing the question. The truth is that there are two ways in the Gemara to address the question. The first, Mipnimah Lo Asur, why is she not forbidden to him? It's a different approach altogether. I think Jana, I think you mentioned this earlier, which is the assumption that hatam ones hava, that she, the only time adultery creates the stigma, the status, the death penalty, the prohibition for eternity, etc., is when it is willing on both sides. But in this particular case, she, says the Gemara in the first answer, is not an equal willing partner in the story. She is forced, says the Gemara. Ones hava. That being forced changes the equation because ones and niyuf are two different things. And so the assumption is that in the case of ones, the prohibition to the husband, right? She's not prohibited. In the case of adultery, there's a mandatory requirement that there be divorce, that the husband and wife cannot be together again. In the case of classic adultery, that's the halach. In the case of ones, that's not the case at all. She can go back to her husband. And if she can go back to her husband, then at least legally, after the death of her husband, she could marry she could marry Dove. Might not be the most nicest thing to do or the most ideal thing to do, but at least legally, it would be permissible. And that's one address to the question.
Can we go back to your first point?
Which one?
The one where you said the soldiers in David's army.
Let me work through the onus scenario first, then I'll come back to the get issue. Okay, because we're going to spend most of our time remaining talking about the get. So let me take your question in a second. But at least the first answer in the Gemara is in fact that she was forced, not willing. Now, I think it's a foregone conclusion that the Gemara is not assuming that David physically forced her. I think that's an assumption. That's a fair assumption. But there are many ways to create a situation of forced relations. And one of them is the fact that David is the king. And I think, Ronnie, you said correctly earlier, when the king summons you to the palace, you don't have much of a choice.
Unequal power dynamics is what they would say in today.
Correct. And I think that and that would certainly halachically qualify as an onus. And I think that that has a lot of validity to it. And on a certain level, that's the simplest explanation, is to recognize the imbalance between where David is and where she is. And therefore, David is accountable, but it's not a classic case of adultery. And therefore, she can return to her husband. David tries to get her husband to return to her. Doesn't happen for other reasons. And eventually, that also means that we don't apply the principle of kishem she'asur labal kach asur labal. If she's not prohibited to return to her husband, then there's no restriction to marry the David after the death of Uriah. That is one level of dealing with the question. It has its own problems. It is not that straightforward an answer. I'm gonna leave the question of why I'm uncomfortable with this answer for now. I want to address it a little bit later. But suffice it to say, let's just talk about one part of the principle, one part of the piece of the puzzle. If she was forced, or whatever, physically or by status and the imbalance of power, etc., the moment she discovers that she was pregnant, in a normal context, what should she have done? If she was forced, if she was unwilling, if she was violated by David and therefore not prohibited to her husband, in a classic context, she discovers she's pregnant, what would she have done?
Tell her husband.
Correct. Tell her husband. But she doesn't tell her husband. She tells David. And that sets in motion everything that transpires afterwards. So to suggest that she's totally unwilling, complete bypass, totally passive, no role in the story because she's forced, when in fact the catalyst for everything that transpires subsequently is the fact that she tells David that she is with child and not her husband, is problematic. So maybe that's what's driving the alternative, but the alternative is not necessarily less problematic, it's just more complicated, and that's an assumption that's not in the text. And the assumption that's not in the text is that there is somehow this get that every soldier wrote to his wife. Now, we have no source for this get other than this story. In other words, the Gemara is assuming this as a resolution of all of our mysteries. We have no alternative, we have no outside source for this idea that every soldier in the army of David gave their wives a get. We just have this statement to Rabbi Yonatan that was in fact the case, resolves a problem possibly. And we're going to see exactly what it solves and what it doesn't solve momentarily. But first, Alan had a question.
Well, just in terms of the get, that doesn't take effect till the soldier dies, does it? So in effect,
that's one of the questions. So let's deal with all these questions. So the moment you're dealing with a get, you're dealing with a very complex halachic structure. The get is a very complex halachic structure. It's called a sefer kritut. It's a bill of divorce, a bill of separation, and or severing of the relationship. It's an entire tractate in the Talmud, the laws of Gittin, and it has multiple variables. So the question is, assuming we're dealing with the get scenario to resolve the adultery issue, The questions that get raised are, why write a get? What is the get supposed to achieve? When is it valid? When does it apply? What are the what kind of status does it create between husband and wife in the interim? What's going on? What is the status of this get? So I want to, this is way more complex than we can address in the 10 minutes that we have left, or even in the context of this kind of a shir. It's an enormous halachic sugya in the Gemara in Gittin. It applies to the principle of get al tnai. Can you apply a conditional get? Can you apply a get that applies retroactively? Right? So there's a lot of variables, but I just want to show you a couple of pieces of information. Rashi in Baba Metzia, when this subject is addressed, calls, there's a Gemara there, and I think I shared this Gemara with you once before, that refers to the members of the Sanhedrin poking fun at David and saying, hey, David, what's the status? What's the rule of somebody who has a relationship with a Suffolk Eshet Ish? Somebody who is unclear whether they are in the status of married or not married. Right? Suffolk, doubt of the status of marriage. Suffolk Eshet Ish, says Rashi, she's a Suffolk. She's not definitely married. She's not definitely not married. Why? Somebody who goes to war always writes a get. So that in the case that if they should die, then the condition applies that retroactively she would be considered divorced. I want to do that again. According to Rashi, Amenat she'im yamut, this get is given, the husband gives the wife a get and says, this get is yours on condition, what we call a get al tnai, that if in fact I should die in battle, you should be divorced from this moment retroactively. Not from the moment of death, but retroactively. Now that's machloket, because there are those who say in the Gemara that the get is valid, but only the moment before he dies. In other words, you can't give a get on Monday and say, if I die on Wednesday, you will be divorced from Monday. But rather, if I give a get on Monday and I say, if I die, the get will be valid the moment before my death, then the status of the wife through all those days is that she's completely married until a moment before the death. Rashi doesn't learn like that. Rashi assumes that the get is retroactive to the moment it was given. But that's why in the interim, she's in a status of a suffolk, because you don't know if the husband is going to die or not. If the husband doesn't die, there's no get. If the husband dies, then the get is valid from the moment it was given. That's Rashi's position. It makes for a very complicated story, because essentially what it means is that when David slept with Bathsheba, he did not know, right? At that moment in time, she was in this middle status called Suffolk Eshet Ish, because until Uriah dies, she is not, she's married. Only after the death of Uriah does kicks in that she is now divorced from before their night together. Very complicated. Rashi makes it extraordinarily difficult. Rashi also throws an interesting variable that the purpose of the get is so that she shouldn't require yibum. And Tosfot immediately challenges that, because yibum is only required in a case where there are no children. That means that this get is only required in the circumstance where the husband goes to war, but there are no children. If there are children, it's not necessary. And that's not what the Gemara says. The Gemara says, anybody, any soldier who went to war, and so Tosfot says that it was more about igun, that the husband, if the husband dies and the body is not found and the wife is left without a divorce, then you have an aguna situation. And so Tosfot says that that applies to every soldier who went to war. So that's a separate discussion. But the other piece of it is Tosfot says, "Mefarish Rabbeinu Tam, Shita Rabbeinu Tam, de Memachemet Beit David ayu megashin legamre belo shum tna." Tosfot takes big issue with Rashi's interpretation because a get al tnai is very complicated. Conditional get, it's not sure, clear at all how it operates. And on top of it, Rashi says it operates retroactively, which means that if Urya doesn't die, the get is not valid. Rabbeinu Tam says that can't be. It has to be that the get is complete, the get is absolute. He gives every soldier, gives his wife a get completely without hesitation. And that is, in fact, and that the get is valid immediately. The truth of the matter is there's a glaring challenge to Rashi's interpretation in the story, in the text. Because according to Rashi, as long as Urya is alive, the marriage between Urya and Bathsheba is 100% valid. The marriage does not get annulled or divorced retroactively unless Urya dies. That assumes that David's intention in bringing the Urya back from the battlefield was to have Urya killed. If Urya doesn't die, then according to Rashi, Bathsheba is married and there's adultery and it doesn't resolve any of our challenges. It's classic adultery in every sense, in the legal sense of the term, because the get is a conditional get only valid retroactively if the husband dies.
But if she has a baby and it's Urya's and he dies, then she's not a Yivam.
That's another problem.
Right. But, and it's fair game for David.
Not Urya's. The baby is David's. But when David calls Urya back from the battlefield, he sends Urya home. He doesn't send Urya back to be killed. He sends Urya home. If he sends Urya home, that sounds like he's trying to cover up for the child. But on the divorce issue, it's assuming that he assumes that there's not a case of adultery here. You follow? So Rashi's interpretation is extraordinarily difficult. It's one of the reasons why Tosfot says that can't be. It has to be an immediate divorce, it has to be a full divorce, and it has to be without condition. So that's on one level, that's the machlokah between Rashi and Tosfot, and there's a bunch of other opinions that weigh in on the halachic nuances of how this operates. But at the end of the day...
But that could mean that Urya was taking the position that he was divorced and didn't want to go home.
It depends on whether you're reading the divorce the way Rashi does or Tosfot does.
Right, but it means that he could be thinking that.
According to Tosfot reads it, it's possible. Okay, so where are we at? We looked at, I'm going to stop sharing for a second. Where are we at? Where we at is at a crossroads. We've looked at the text of the story of the relationship between Urya and between David and Bathsheba that first night and raised the question of, can it be adultery? Is it adultery? On the one hand, the Torah, the Navi describes Bathsheba and Urya as Eshet Urya Achiti three times, both in the story and in Natan's punishment or criticism of David. On the other hand, the issue of adultery is ignored in the sense of the ability for them to marry afterwards, in the sense of it doesn't seem to be a relation that takes place in secret, in the sense of the Navi's criticism of David, that he doesn't make reference to the adultery, the fact that he uses a mashal to kind of hide the story, what's to hide if there was an act of adultery. All of this is complicated. That's part one. Then we looked at the question, okay, so if it's not, how is it that it could not be adultery? What are the options? How could it possibly be that they would not be guilty of adultery? And we looked at two possibilities. One is onus, the fact that it could very well be that he takes her in a kind of a fashion in which makes her unwilling partner to it. We'll explore that in much more detail, Bezrat Hashem, next week. But that's one possibility. And the other possibility is this concept of a get that the Gemara suggests is another option, that every soldier wrote a get for his wife. Unclear how such a get operates. Whether it operates conditionally, operates retroactively. When do you give the get? You give the get before you go to battle for the purpose of avoiding aguna, which means it only applies, avoiding yibum, which means it only applies to families that don't have children, or does it and siblings, or does it apply to everybody? Is it to avoid igun? If it's to avoid igun, is it valid right away? Does it create literally a normal divorce situation where a husband divorces his wife and now they're not married at all? And when he comes back, hopefully he'll remarry her. Is that the scenario, says Tosfot? Or as Rashi suggests, it's a conditional get. He gives it to her on condition that he'll, if he dies, the get will be valid retroactively, which doesn't solve the problem for David in any way. That's one part of the complexity. The other part of the complexity is there's no reference to this get story in the text of Sefer Shmuel or anywhere else in Tanakh, anywhere. And so it's possible that the text is trying to avoid reference to it, not in order that we shouldn't lower the level of accountability to David, because the purpose of the story is always to raise the level of accountability and to hold David accountable for the moral offense, if not the legal one. And so it doesn't make reference to the get, but it leaves us with the question of, is there a third alternative? Is there another way to read the story that allows for the self-justification on David's part that would enable him to think that at least legally this was acceptable and then be held accountable morally, without getting into the question of the get? Is there a third option for us? And that third option we will, Bezrat Hashem, look at next week in more detail. Vivian, I'll kind of in advance reference back to something that you said, raises a very interesting question, which is the reason why Uriah is referred to as Uriah Hachiti. Not the only individual to be referred to that way. We have many such people in Tanakh and in Sefer Shmuel who are identified by their locale. And in fact, most people in Tanakh, in Sefer Shmuel, are identified by where they come from, not necessarily a reflection of their Jewish status. So we will explore that question in much more detail, Bezrat Hashem, next week.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I go back to what you said about the fact that Natan used a mashal?
Thank you.
I didn't quite catch that.
In other words, it's odd for a Navi to come to criticize the king and start with stories. If you have something to say, so say it. The Nevi'im weren't afraid of speaking truth to power. It's usually a literary device that was employed when the level of accountability is unclear. In other words, when the story is unclear, when the facts are unclear, and you need the text, you need the king to kind of weigh in on the judgment, then the mashal helps. But just if you're guilty of adultery, like, why would you not just say it? So we'll explore it in more detail when we get to chapter 12.
Great. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Have a wonderful day or evening.
Thanks. Well, to you.